Hello, everyone. This is Eric Pennington, and welcome to the Spirit of EQ podcast. We're glad that you've tuned in. A few things we wanted to tell you at the beginning of the show, and that's this podcast was created to be a tool to help you, primarily to discover and grow your EQ. Science and our own lived experiences confirm that the better we are at managing our emotions, the better we're going to be at making decisions, which leads to a better life. And that's something we all want. We're glad that you've taken out the time today to listen and hope that something that you hear will lead to a breakthrough. Hey, one last thing. We'd really appreciate a review on whichever platform you use to listen. And if you want to, leave some comments about what you heard today, as well as follow and subscribe. That way you won't miss a single episode as we continue this journey. And with that, the show begins. Welcome, everyone, to the Spirit of EQ podcast. I'm Eric Pennington, and with me, as always, is Jeff East. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Hi, Eric, and all our listeners.
So today, we have a very special guest, Josh Friedman, who is the CEO of 6 Seconds. And I'm really excited about today, Jeff, because, you know, sometimes Josh comes to my mind at the most odd times, right? And one of those, and I'm not going to embarrass him too much, but it was some wisdom, Josh. I remember watching a video, and I've used this video in sessions before, where you talked about how your brain can also make you good at something you don't like. So when I'm in that place, you know, where I'm evaluating, why do I keep doing that? And just remember, Eric, your brain can make you really good at the things you don't like, too. So it's great to have you here, Josh. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
Yes, and I don't think you need help after you explained why you think of Josh.
Thank you, Jeff, for encouraging me on my journey. All right. So, hey, Josh, I'm going to jump right in. Right now, there's a lot of talk about business and how to navigate this new world we found ourselves in and the connection to solving sort of these new problems. And I say it that way because there tends to be this conversation about, well, we seem to be trying to use the old solutions for these new problems. And quite frankly, in most conversations I have, it doesn't work. Mm. And it's not that there's not a lack of desire to solve. It's just, well, what do we do if the old solutions don't work? So I want to kind of go in the direction of, what do you think the role of EQ can be in that sort of the pursuit of solving some of these problems? I know we're not going to solve them all today, certainly, but in general.
So I'd say there's a couple of questions to unpack there, Eric. One is, I mean, let's just take a problem like employee engagement. Mm-hmm. And we know that in teams, in organizations where there's greater employment and engagement, there's greater productivity, there's greater performance, there's many times higher level of profit. And for a very long time now, employee engagement has been sort of stubbornly in the US in the, you know, sort of 25-30%, and now it's down to 21%. Mm. And so as an organizational leader, either you don't really believe that, or you don't think it's true, you know, yeah, sure, across the nation, engagement is 21%, but that's not really affecting my business. Mm. Or you're saying, well, I just don't know what to do about that. But it seems to me like business leaders, if they really believe that they're getting a fifth of the productivity value from what they're spending on employees, that they would say, we absolutely are going to change that.
Josh, how would you describe an engaged employee?
An engaged employee feels, and this key word, feels like this is my place, my work. I care. I show up. I do more than the minimum. I do it because it's important. I see what has to get done, and I put my energy. Fred Smith, who founded FedEx, talked about discretionary effort. And I know Eric has heard that term a million times in his previous life at FedEx. Discretionary effort. You pay people for a certain level of effort. And anything they do above that is at their discretion. It's a gift from the employee. Why do they give that gift? Because they care. And so as a, whether you're talking about your teenagers, you know, taking out the trash, or you're talking about your students, like doing extra, you know, things on in class, or whether you're talking about your employees going that extra mile, they go the extra mile because of engagement. And that engagement is rooted in emotion.
So I was going to throw out to Josh, because this maybe, I've always felt that sometimes when leaders say, well, it's not affecting my business, it typically is they're looking at potentially a P&L, right? Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think that numbers are a very deceiving thing because they can mask problems, a la, well, we're up 20%, so everything must be great. So what is the role of EQ there? I mean, in helping a leader understand that it's not just that.
Eric, you talked about the brain earlier, and one of the fantastic things about the human brain that's also very problematic is that our brains normalize almost anything.
Wow.
And yeah. So what normalization means is we just adapt, right? And you can be in a very problematic circumstance and, you know, after some time, you just go, well, that's just kind of the way things are. And we've seen, you know, we see people are incredibly resilient, and we see people surviving and even thriving in terrible circumstances. And it just becomes normal. And so we could take an extreme situation, like somebody who's in an abusive relationship, and they might say over time, well, yes, I know this is an abusive relationship, but at least I know what it is. At least I know what I'm in for. And so what's happened is they've normalized. Their brain has just kind of gone, you know what? It's bad, but there's something comfortable about this known situation. And I think a lot of business leaders have just gotten used to having a large percentage of their employee base disengaged or neutral. And then just kind of like, well, it's just kind of, that's how it is. That's part of the cost of doing business. And yet, when you are on a team and when you're in an organization where people are actually engaged, you feel it and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, it seems like a rarity, but I think that's just a failure of imagination to say, like, wow, we actually could have, you know, 80% engagement, and that could be the norm.
So can EQ help that leader who maybe has a brain that's gone to the normalization of non-engagement?
Part of the function of emotions is to provide a different perspective. Mm-hmm. So every feeling that we feel is saying, you know, hey, Jeff, did you notice this? Hey, Jeff, did you notice this? Right? And it's like with you two, you know, you might be talking and you might kind of give Jeff a little nudge and say, Jeff, hey, what about your parking? Right? And that little nudge is just a reminder to pay attention to something. And at a fundamental level, emotions are signals to help us pay attention to opportunities and threats. And so if we can tune into emotion and use it for what it's there for, which is these adaptive messages, we become more tuned into that data and we're more effectively able to respond to that data. So essentially all intelligence is about accurately acquiring and effectively using data. Mathematical intelligence, we're accurate in acquiring that mathematical data and we effectively use it to make our spreadsheet balance. Emotional intelligence, we accurately collect that emotional data about how we and others are feeling and we effectively use it to solve a problem on a problem like engagement. I think the problem is when we try to use mathematical intelligence for an emotional problem. So we say, well, I'm going to get good numerical data about engagement, but you're missing. This is not actually just, there is a numerical component of it. Like 21% of people in the US are engaged. That's a numerical problem. Why? That's an emotional problem.
Yeah.
And we need our emotional intelligence to help us tap in and go, let me dig deeper. But the reality is most businesses and most business leaders haven't prioritized developing emotional intelligence. And so that data is left on the table.
Do you think, and this is kind of off of the beaten, do you think that the, maybe it's now called the era of the pandemic, do you think that that was sort of the catalyst disruptor that sort of is forcing the hand of business leaders around what you just described? Or
I think that businesses that had a really transactional culture and low trust and poor relationships, I think a lot of them have folded in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of them are deeply struggling right now. And organizations that have had a higher level of trust, more connection, a more relational approach, had managers who could call up somebody and say, hey, let's figure this out, those organizations have adapted more effectively. I would like to think that this is a wake-up call to say, hey, we actually have to deal with these relational challenges. And yet we know that the human brain, when people are in distress, the human brain likes to go back to what's known and what's comfortable and follow the old patterns. And the risk is, in this context of disruption, mm-hmm. for people to say, oh, I'm distressed, this is bad, we got to double down on what we did 5 years ago. And that is probably not an intelligent response.
Yeah, that's really powerful. So you were mentioning that, and maybe I saw somewhere, but I think you were talking about that there's some pretty compelling data that has just been sort of acquired around some of this kind of topic. But can you open up that a little bit about what you were speaking of? This is when we were talking off air.
Yeah, so we just published the 2023 Business Case for Emotional Intelligence. Mm. This is one of our most downloaded reports from sixseconds.org. And we last published it in 2016. And in 2016, we had pretty compelling data about the business benefits of emotional intelligence. What's interesting to me is that in 2023, the benefits seem to have increased. In other words, the predictive value of emotional intelligence seems to be going up. And I think that's connected to what you just asked, Eric, that in a context of increased complexity, increased distress, the tools that help people navigate distress and complexity are even more important. And so this is becoming a leadership imperative. And my guess is that a couple of years from now, we'll say, wow, we have even more complexity and we have even a faster pace of change than we did. We'll look back with nostalgia on 2023 and say, you know, it was relatively calm then before, you know, we had the war of the AIs trying to take over.
Yes. And as I know, you know, Josh, I have some pointed opinions about AI.
Are you worried about Skynet again?
No, there is none of that. None of that, Jeff. From that perspective, Josh, because this is the other thing that I've noticed, like at times, you know, there's, you know, if you could imagine someone who's at a bus stop and they're waiting for a bus, right? And the bus isn't on time. The bus is 2 hours. It's 5 hours. And then there's the recognition that the bus is probably not coming. The idea that I'm waiting for this thing to just, can we get to a place where there's not as much change?
When are we going back to normal?
Right. You know, how many times have you heard that, right? And you just alluded to something about 2025 and ahead. And I'm in your tribe in this sense that I think we're just beginning some of this major transitional change, right? I mean, is that how you see it, or?
I think that the pandemic has been shocking in how widespread the disruption was.
Right.
And I heard people say, you know, at first, oh, we're all in the same boat. And then other people said, we're all in the same storm, but some of us are in a yacht and some of us in a raft. We're all in the same storm. And it's been a very big, very widespread storm. And I think that has been shocking for us. And this pace of disruption has been increasing and increasing and increasing. And unfortunately, what I hear from scientist friends is we're likely to see more pandemics in the next decade, not less.
Right.
But we're also likely to see other kinds of disruption, you know, a once in 100-year weather events. And I'm living here in a place where we've just gone through a level of rain and flooding and storms and that, you know, we've never seen in my or my parents' lifetimes, probably not in my grandparents' lifetimes. And we're seeing more and more of these. We've never seen something like this before. And at the beginning of the pandemic, you remember, we were hearing over and over, oh, we're in an unprecedented situation. And I think that the brutal reality is we are going to remain in an unprecedented situation.
Yeah. You know, it brings me back, and Jeff, you and I, maybe we have talked about this before. I had a friend of mine, and his kids are around the same age as mine. They're young adults, you know, just out of college type deal. And he said, I think we raised them well. And I said, yeah, I agree with you. And I said, the thing that really leaps out to me, I think we help them understand about how to, not completely, but how to navigate life even when the circumstances mm-hmm. don't match up to their expectations, right? This idea that I can still be healthy and adjusted even if there is this, you know, rapid change and consistent chaos, if I can call it that. And I say it that way, Josh, because I want to have a sense of the optimism that it doesn't, and I know you well enough to know that you're not just saying doom and gloom, we should all run for cover. It's this idea that, and this is where emotional intelligence really is so valuable, is it can help us navigate. It can help us go, well, you know, I didn't want that situation, but it happened. So what are my options? Or how can I be more empathetic? All of those different things. And I just thought I'd throw that out there too, just for the
I appreciate that. And I think for whether we're talking about, you know, in our families or in our businesses, in our communities, if we are in this time of incredibly complex change and a lot of rapid change and a lot of disruption, we can say, oh, well, I just want to try to keep things the same. And then we're going to end up in a place of just tremendous burnout and it's not going to work. If we want to be functional in this, we need companies that are structured for resilience. We need families that are structured for resilience. We need communities that are adaptive. And rigid mechanistic systems don't work well in big storms. So I live in California, and you know, in the 1906 earthquake, lots and lots of buildings just collapsed. But we've had in my lifetime multiple earthquakes in California that have been that size, and buildings aren't collapsing. And the reason is that these buildings are now engineered, understanding the circumstance, understanding the threat vectors, and saying, okay, well, we have to build buildings that have a built-in resilience, built-in agility. But I don't think we've done that with businesses.
So, Josh, how would you, you're talking to a business, how would you go about showing them those threat vectors, like you just mentioned?
So the new business case talks about the costs of low emotional intelligence, the costs of lost productivity. Lost productivity in the United States estimates $1.8 trillion a year in loss. And again, I think most business leaders they're not confronting that. They're saying, yeah, so, you know, we have a 22% turnover right now, but that's just the way things are. And not realizing, oh, that employee turnover, every employee is costing us 1 to 2 salaries plus lost productivity. And trying to quantify it and confront that, we don't have to just kind of go with, like, it is what it is. We actually have capacities and skills that we can build to change and address these challenges. So we have 4 steps in the new business case of how you get organizational value with emotional intelligence. And none of them is do a workshop. The first step of the 4 is to really understand this business case and to look at the culture that's going to support your strategy and understand at a senior level to get alignment around why are we needing to build a culture intentionally? What kind of culture is going to support the value creation that we're trying to build as a business? And depending on the type of business that you're building and the way that you create value in your business, you need a culture that supports and aligns to that. And that step is about shifting your thinking away from, you know, 1950 and going to 2050 and saying, all right, we're going to have to build a system in our business that's going to work like those kids that you talked about. They're going to be able to adapt and grow and flourish even when things aren't working the way we expect.
So this has to be top down.
Well, there are four steps, and not all four steps are top down. And as you know well, Jeff, leadership is important, and I think that it makes a lot of difference, and it's insufficient. Leaders without followers. One of our old FedEx friends, Jimmy Daniel, used to say, "You know what you call a leader without followers? A guy going for a walk by himself." Right. So we need followership. We need culture. We need people to engage. And leadership is not about position. Leadership is something that's across an organization. You know, I've met plenty of 6-year-old kids who demonstrate strong leadership. So it's leadership is a capacity, and we do need it at a senior level in organizations. And I'm afraid there are some organizations that lack it. We also need culture, which is co-created by everyone. And when we measure this in organizations, what we see is that often it's somebody in a fairly junior position who is actually a major driver of trust or distrust, a major driver of collaboration or silos. And it's how we build that together and do it strategically that I think is part of the leadership imperative.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And for those of you out in the audience listening today, we will make sure to have a link in the show notes to that report for you. So, Josh, if I may, I wanted to pivot a little bit to the individual listener who may or may not be in the corporate world, or, you know, could be someone who's in school, could be any other facet of life that doesn't necessarily directly relate to business. And I've noticed it. Jeff has noted it as well. You've said it in times I've heard in talks and in writing. There are a lot of people right now who are really struggling. And they may be out there today listening, going, that's wonderful that the CEOs of the world need to become better leaders, but I'm just struggling on how am I going to take the next step and choose where am I going to live? Am I going to stay in this relationship? Why can't I seem to get a handle on what I'm feeling? All of those different things. So it's kind of a two-parter. So what kind of tips would you give to someone who's just saying, okay, I've heard about this EQ thing and I think I may want to take the first steps. What would you say to them? But then also talk about this environment of struggle and we can unwrap that as well.
So maybe let's start with the second.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the data is pretty disturbing and compelling that distress is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
People are suffering, some in a very profound way, and almost everyone to some degree. So we're on average, you know, the three of us, the other people in the studio with us, all the people listening, on average, we're more lonely, we're more stressed than we were 5 years ago. And the younger you are, the more likely it is that that's true. In our research, younger people are considerably more affected by it's primarily from the pandemic, the disconnection, the sense of uncertainty is even more profound. And so in that context, I think that there are a lot of people who are in pain. And we are in our offices, in our classrooms, in our churches, synagogues, mosques, you know, our colleagues in a coffee shop, somebody we meet, they're carrying heavier rocks. And in that, you know, they're more dysregulated, meaning they're more likely to be volatile. They're more likely to be either attacking or defending. They're more likely to be acting out or acting in, hurting themselves, hurting others.
Mm-hmm.
And what that suggests is, you know, on the one hand, we need more clinical support. We need more counselors. We need more people whose this is their profession. But we also need all of us. We need as friends, as managers, as teachers, as pastors, at all walks of life, the people who are coming into our circles are needing more from us emotionally.
You know, I can agree with what you're saying. As I go through the day, when I say, ask someone, how are they doing? I mean it. And when they go, okay, I'll dig a little bit. And you'd be amazed how many people will unload to a complete stranger.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are saying they're okay and they're not okay. And that's not to say, you know, broken. That's not to say you need to go be hospitalized. I'm saying that just in our day-to-day burdens are become more difficult. And so that means, again, that as individuals, we have greater demands that are being placed on us at this relational space. And so I think that's a call for all of us to say, okay, I have to grow my capacity. I have to grow my capacity to do what Jeff just talked about. To grow my capacity to be that stranger, you know, on the train, or that colleague at work, or, you know, that caregiver of some kind who's able to support people. The great news is these are learnable skills.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And that's something that we've, I don't know, for lack of a better way of saying it, Jeff, you know, we've kind of sort of banged that gong consistently, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I think about too, Josh, is this idea of, you know, you mentioned about carrying burdens, heavier rocks and things like that. And I know from my own life, and I've tried to be, and I'm working toward being even more intentional about paying attention to the weight of the rocks I'm carrying, and then also paying attention to, are they really mine to be carrying?
Mm.
You know? And what I have found is that there is this tendency, and I'm sure this has some personality dynamic to it, of where I have to offload. And it's not, I don't kick relationships to the curb or anything. It's just, it's at, okay, I get it. I understand. I'm listening and I'll be here, but I can't take that weight for you.
Mm.
Right. And I'm just using my own personal example here. Others have different dynamics. I get it. But I do believe in order to be healthy, I need to have less weight. Because if you think about the dynamic of that, the more weight you carry, the more difficult it is to move and to move forward.
Mm.
So from that perspective, if that person out there who says, I really don't know much about this EQ thing, what's a starting point, Josh, that you might recommend that they begin the journey? They've heard it from us tons of times on the podcast, but with your background and your experiences, I think it'd be very helpful.
For me, one of the basic, powerful realizations is that I didn't have to do something about emotions. I could just pay attention to them. I didn't need to fix it. I don't need to fix yours. You know, if I ask, if we trade roles here and I ask Jeff how he's doing and he really tells me, and I realize that, you know, there's a lot of difficult stuff going on for him, that doesn't mean I have to do anything. I don't have to take responsibility for it. As you said, Eric, that's not my rock to pick up. I can just stand with you and go, yeah, that sounds tough. And that in itself, that realization that I'm not my emotions, I don't have to fix my emotions, I'm not trying to fix other people's emotions. I'm just acknowledge. That was incredibly liberating for me. The other piece is, before I started studying emotional intelligence, I thought of emotions as somewhat random. They just kind of happened. And realizing, actually, there's a functional purpose of emotion. I can learn what that is. I'm a pretty rational person. And I don't have to stop being a rational person to be emotionally intelligent. But I can use my rational skills. I can use my analytical skills to understand more about emotion and go, okay, that's what it means. And that has made me more comfortable with feelings and even difficult feelings, realizing there's no such thing as negative feelings. There's just some feelings are tough. And just like you have some, you know, some advisors, some people in your life who, you know, you might talk to and you might find their advice kind of tough to swallow, but you still might ask them because they provide a useful perspective. You don't have to obey them.
Right.
But you're inquiring and you're getting some perspective. So if you think about emotions like that, as advisors that are giving you perspective, and you go, oh, that's interesting. That's all you have to do. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. That's that's awesome. Because I think about that dynamic and how it has affected me personally is, I mean, I was the type, Josh, where, you know, before getting into the work that we do, I had like these compartments. You know, there were the emotions that were, oh, yeah, that's cool. There were emotions, oh, I really like it when that happens. And then there were those emotions like, I'm trying to figure out how can I minimize the chances that that emotion is going to come my way, typically connected to past memory, past experience, all of that kind of thing. And in probably the last 5 to 10 years, the dynamic has changed a bit, connecting to what you were saying, where it's going, okay, wait a minute. Why don't you just sit with that anger for a minute and just listen a little? Don't be quick to judge it, because it might be trying to help you.
I remember long before we started 6 Seconds, Annabelle Jensen, who's the president of 6 Seconds, I've now been working with and for Annabelle for over 30 years. And the reason, I think, is captured in this story. I was a young teacher. She was the head of school. And I remember going to her and saying, I think I might be depressed. It's a little bit of a long story behind that. But the key thing was, I was totally expecting her to say, oh, don't worry, you're fine. And what she said was, yeah, I can imagine why you'd be feeling depressed. I think if I was in your situation, I'd feel depressed too. So why don't you let yourself feel depressed for a little while? I'm like, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to tell me, cheer me up, you know?
Right. Fix it, yeah.
But I walked out of that meeting kind of with a bounce in my step going, okay, great. So I'm a little bit depressed. That's great. All right, I got it. But it was just the that sense of like, you're feeling what you're feeling for a reason. And you don't need to run away from that. You don't need to fix it. You don't. And she said something else to me that was really important, which was, if you need help getting out, why don't you just let yourself be depressed for a few days? And then if you need help getting out of it, come back and talk to me. So it wasn't just like stay in the pain, but you don't need to fix it right now. And that I felt like was a level of respect for my own experience and kind of the opposite of toxic positivity, right? Mm-hmm. Just like embracing you're a whole and healthy person, even when things aren't going so well, and you have the resources. And I think that in my own work as a coach, as a teacher, a big part of what I want people to experience is that sense of you have that strength inside you and you have those resources. And if you need help, there are people who can help you, but fundamentally you have it.
Yeah, yeah. I think about that too, Josh. I was watching a video. It was an interview with Simon Sinek, and he said that he hated the word or the words mental health. He said he likes to look at it as mental fitness. And he drew a wonderful analogy of that, you know, when you go to the gym and you're lifting weights or whatever type of exercise. And he said, you imagine those times when you ate the right foods, you drank the right amount of liquid, you're hydrated, you've got the right clothes, the right shoes, you get to the gym and nothing goes like you wanted it to. That was just a day where it just didn't click. Mm-hmm. Versus looking at it as there's something wrong with me. Mm. You know, there's something that needs to be fixed. It's like, well, why don't you, because when you mentioned that story with Annabelle, I'm going, this kind of connects directly to what you're saying. You know, it's like, it's okay. It's okay to feel that way. You know, it doesn't mean that everything else fundamentally is off, right? And, you know, for many people, I think sometimes that, and I don't know your thoughts on it, Josh and Jeff, you can chime in as well. You know, this feeling of isolation that I'm the only one. And I'm carrying the greatest burden, and I don't want to diminish someone who actually feels that way, but I think that's maybe one of the dangers of the isolation. And you mentioned loneliness, the level of loneliness, right? Any thoughts around that? Maybe specifically to the lonely factor that you mentioned.
So I would say I really want people to hear: sometimes you need help. Right. And if you are in a place where you are not finding your way out of the darkness, you're not finding your way out of the isolation, there are people who can help you.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's clinical help. Sometimes that's pastoral help. Sometimes that's friend help. Sometimes it's a coach. Depending on what your needs are, there are people who can help you and you deserve help.
Yeah.
And there's no shame in asking for help when you need it. And for all of us, in addition to that help, we also need the resources of our own care, of our own strengthening internally, of our own work. And I think every psychiatrist will say, you know, like, okay, we can give you some medication, but that won't fix it by itself. It'll help. But you're going to also need to do some other work. And even if you don't need clinical care, you do need that other work. You need that work of maintaining and connecting and getting out of your own way and getting out of the old patterns and being in that stuck space. So there's a piece about resourcefulness. And I guess the message that I want to give is wherever you are on that spectrum, from, you know, really deep clinical suffering to pretty healthy but suffering, there are resources that you can strengthen in yourself and in your community, in your business, in your family, in your classroom, in your, you know, everywhere in your life. They're relational, they're with each other, and they're internal. And the skills of emotional intelligence are the learnable, measurable, scientifically grounded skills that equip us to deal with these emotional complexities. And so wherever you are on this spectrum, these are tools that are going to help you, and you can learn them.
Yeah. So there's something that you mentioned there too. There is he's a doctor, Peter Attia, and he has a podcast called The Drive. And I remember watching an episode, and it kind of connects to David Tubley as well, a gentleman that all three of us know. And I remember being in a conversation with David, and he was talking about the importance of building resources, right? Because you can only call upon the resources you've built up until the time that you encounter that change, crisis, and whatever. And in this episode of this Drive podcast, he's talked about this method that he helps people, because he's really big into longevity, right? And he said he typically tells his clients or his patients, I want you to think about the decade as far out as you feel like you're going to live. And he said some people will, for example, they'll say, well, yeah, I think I could probably make it to 90, right? Mm-hmm. And then he said, basically what I want them to do then is to take 30 years off of 90 and then ask yourself, what do I need to be doing at that age to prepare me for 90? Hmm. With a connection to, okay, what are some of the things you want to be able to do when you're 90? Well, I want to be able to pick up my grandkids, or I want to be able to go for a walk. So the time to prepare, take that 30 years back. And it's not my call for everyone out there to adopt his program for longevity, physical health, and all that, but the point of building resources.
Mm.
I think that's vital.
Yeah, two things come up for me about that. One is the number one predictor of longevity is actually relationships.
Ah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's more predictive than whether you smoke or not. No, I'm not saying, okay, so now start smoking, right? Right. But like, it's interesting. We are social animals, and relationships are the number one predictor of our longevity. There's a, you know, this great work from the Grant study and a new book that came out. His name's eluding me at the moment, but about what really makes people successful in the long term,
mm-hmm.
and the answer is relationship. The other piece of that I want to just double click on is this idea of looking ahead and saying, it's one thing to say, okay, things are really crap today, and I can deal with it, or I can deal with it, you know, or I need help, or I don't, whatever. Like that's one condition. But it's so much smarter to say, what are things going to be like tomorrow? What's coming up next week? Oh, I've got that big presentation next week. And I know that when I do presentations, I get really stressed out. So it's this 30-year plan, but let's just back it up to a week. I've got this thing coming up in a week, and I know that's going to be really stressful. And so what am I going to do to help me prepare for that next week? Right. You know, I have this conversation that I've got going on. I can look at my calendar. I can see this stuff happening. What am I going to do now? And what I'm going to do now is physical, mental, spiritual. I can't remember. Physical, mental, spiritual,
emotional.
Emotional. Emotional work.
Funny we talk about that.
Right? And that's going to be, you know, that's going to be the gym. I'm going to go to the EQ gym. We have a book called The EQ Gym, so you literally can go to the EQ gym.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go to the EQ gym. I'm going to go to the spiritual gym. I'm going to go to the physical gym. I'm going to go to the mental gym. I'm going to strengthen these different areas because I know that next week I'm going to need those resources.
You know,
that's great.
Eric was talking about 30 years. You're talking about next week. With my situation that I have to deal with, it's sometimes in 2 minutes.
Mm.
And you have to make that a habit. When I get out of the habit of doing what I need to do, then I find myself in trouble.
Yeah. And if you kind of take your eyes off the prize, and then stuff comes up and explodes in your face, and you're like, I'm lost. Whereas if you're really clear on what's important and what you're doing and how you're showing up in these 2 minutes, that challenge, it's still really hard, I can imagine. And it doesn't kind of knock you off course for the rest of your day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Josh, now I have a question for you that it's always been a curiosity for me. You've been in this work for a long time. Not that that means anything, or in the sense of time, age, and all of that stuff.
Are you saying I'm old?
Oh, well, right. I'm trust me.
I got some wrinkles from...
This is truly about the commitment you've made to this work. So why so much of your life for EQ?
I think part of it is because we teach what we need to learn.
Mm.
I think part of it is that I felt lonely and disconnected a lot of my life. And this work has helped me feel like I'm part of the future and part of the world. I can connect. I think part of it is because I look at people and I see the needless suffering. I see how many people are miserable about going to work or going to school. I know that these tools, I have the research, I have the experience that these tools make a difference in people's lives, and they make their lives and their businesses better. They make their communities better. They strengthen the fabric against this kind of storms that we're facing. I know it works. And so I feel this sense of urgency that we have more and more people growing these capacities, because it's the challenge that we're facing as human beings, as a planet. This is the difference that makes the difference. And I feel like sometimes I feel like I'm a guy standing on the side of a pool with a life ring in my hand. And people are in the pool going, oh, I'm drowning. I'm like, hey, can I give you this life ring? Like, no, I'm too busy drowning. Like, well, but let me I got to drown right now. And it pains me and it amuses me, you know, but we've got to figure out better ways to give people the life ring.
Yeah.
Or better ways to make them want to grab the life ring.
Yeah. Or believe that the life ring is possible, or that they deserve the life ring.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, and Jeff, you may or may not remember this. One of our clients, Josh, one of the things that he said, the owner of the company, was that there was one particular employee where he saw a market difference, because she had come to him and said, since we've been doing this work, I found it much, how does she put it to him? It was like, I now find it easier to make the choice to be happy.
Mm.
And he saw that in her behaviors before and after. And it wasn't that he said, oh my gosh, her sales are through the roof now and I can't believe it. How can we get other people to do this? It was, wow, I see that difference. And I hear you say that, Josh, I mean, that's kind of the, you know, the overall mission of this work in, you know, general, beyond, you know, whether it's 6 seconds or Spirit of EQ or whatever, is that we have found this thing, this learnable skill, if we would call it that, right, in this context, that if you would have a desire to work on it and have a desire to put in the work, it can make a difference.
And the extra good news with our research in business is that it also makes your business more profitable. It also improves your sales. It reduces your costs. And so that combination, it's not just a nice to have.
Right.
These are tools that make our businesses and communities work better. It makes classrooms work better. It makes families work better. So whatever the outcomes you're looking for, there's now a ton of data, and we have all kinds of case studies across different sectors, including individuals and themselves, where we can see there's a real ROI on this work for individuals, for schools, for businesses. So, you know, it seems like at this point, kind of obvious, like we're facing this challenge. We have these learnable, measurable skills that make a difference. We've got to embed them.
Yeah. And Josh, I didn't mention it, but one of the things about that particular lady is that this owner understands the, I mean, just the vital importance of, she's interfacing with his clients.
Mm-hmm.
They're experiencing her. So I think in some ways it can be easy people to think, well, that's great, she's happy, but what does that have to do with? Well, it has a lot to do with, right? Do you want somebody who comes into your office, who interacts with your customers and is engaged, or would you prefer them to be disengaged? On and on.
I was just at a hotel a couple of weeks ago, and it's kind of an older hotel, and it's nice, but it's not, you know, it's not amazing in terms of its facilities. And I had such a great experience there. And over and over and over, I just, you know, I'm kind of walking down the hall and people like, oh, how is your day going? And good morning. And I felt like, oh, they actually mean that. And there's just like an energy. And we know from the research that emotional energy is contagious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I walk away from that hotel going, yeah, you know what? I want to go back there.
Yeah. All right, Josh. So, hey, I got to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about, before we close out today, what's new and exciting with 6 seconds? I mean, you mentioned the report, but what else is happening that you'd want to tell our audience about?
So we have this new research. We have another study coming out later this year called State of the Heart, which is the world's largest study on emotional intelligence. We have a new framework that we talk about in the business case for how to create business value with emotional intelligence. We've got some fantastic new methods and metrics that we've been using and testing. We have a new program on employee well-being that is very powerful for managers to support themselves and their employees to strengthen well-being. There's a lot of activity happening all over the world in our coach certifications, our consultant certifications. So whether you're looking at this in your business, in your institution, whether you want to become skilled in these tools yourselves, with our partners like Spirit of EQ, incredible work happening to show this stuff is working, and you can get access to it. And so I think there's never been a better time to step into learning and growing emotional intelligence, and whatever space you're in, we're here to support you.
Awesome. Josh, we've enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you.
I'm still trying to figure out how is it that I feel like we just started talking about 5 minutes ago, but nonetheless, that's a great conversation. So once again, thank you so much for joining us. And for those in the audience, we thank you for tuning in. We look forward to the next time that we're together. Take care.
Thank you.